Welcome to the Newcastle Witches Podcast. Thank you for listening. This is episode 14, The North Remembers Not. This episode is dedicated to Elizabeth Dobson. A quick side note. Some of the sound in the beginning of this episode isn't great because my dog Scout decided she wanted to somehow be involved in the recording of this episode, and you might hear her walking around and making a few noises. So we really hope it isn't too distracting for you, and I hope it doesn't take away from some of the really interesting things that Katie is going to say. We are once again joined by Katie, and we're going to be talking about how and why the Newcastle witch trials are rarely spoken about in comparison to other witch trials in England and, in fact, the rest of the world. Thank you for joining us, Katie.
Yeah, it's good to be back. Thank you.
I think it's best to just jump right in because one of the questions that's been running through my mind this entire podcast is, why is there so little known about it? Why was such a huge event in the history of a city just almost, I don't want to say covered up, but how do you forget something so important? How is it even likely? Which I guess is why we're trying to understand, like, what was the motivation or what was the reason why information about this trial wasn't preserved, and almost why, you know, Ralph Gardner seems to be one of the few people really talking about it and documenting it.
Well, I'd say that it's partly because of how horrific these events were and how quickly the Witchfinder was discovered as a fraud that the local elites especially didn't want it to be remembered. So my theory of where the case started to be forgotten is in its very beginning.
Yeah, because we don't really hear much about, sort of, as you said, like, poems or plays or tales from that era of, like, you know, beware, like, you can get convicted of... I don't know, I imagine that people might have done something like that with, you know, written a cautionary tale about the Newcastle witches, and at least we'd have that, but we don't seem to have any of that kind of... Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I know what you mean. I was just thinking that there are pamphlets exposing Matthew Hopkins, for example. So it is quite interesting that we don't get a similar example with the unnamed Newcastle Witchfinder. And I guess, we could put that down to maybe the speed with which he was convicted and executed himself, the Newcastle Witchfinder. Mm-hmm. There wasn't really this space or... I suppose the call to action in a similar way to the Mary Moore pamphlet.
Yeah.
In a way, there's not like the same motivation to say that something must be done about mm-hmm. this.
Well, we know from especially the episodes that we recorded with David Silk that Newcastle at the time was going through a really awful and turbulent period in its history. There was a lot of political upheaval, and you know, they've just executed a lot of people for witchcraft. Maybe, you know, then they had the pressure from Ralph Gardner calling them out on a number of things. So can we assume maybe, like, surely it was in the interest of the local governments to, I guess, suppress this story?
We know that the councilmen were trying to cover up what Ralph was saying himself. So from the year after its publication to the end of the 1650s, there were local officials were actively trying to suppress the spread of England's grievances discovered. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that they were trying to quash people talking about the witch trials elsewhere.
And probably people like Mary Moore were driven to publish their pamphlets in London, maybe because they felt there was a cover-up happening?
Yeah, I'd say that's plausible, like, as well as the wider audience, and if she's feeling that she's not being listened to
yeah.
by local authorities. and perhaps they're trying to protect the image of the region, because even at this time there was still a north-south divide happening. Mm-hmm. And although people who actually travelled into Newcastle and kind of experienced it and met with merchants and things like that, although they would say that the town is very prosperous and enlightened in a way, and a cultural hub, I suppose, there was still in the south and in London this kind of north-south prejudice that we still recognise today. So the idea that the town were trying to protect their reputation is, I'd say, definitely plays a role in mm-hmm. the lack of a legacy for the Newcastle witches.
I guess I'm just trying to understand sort of why, even in the immediate aftermath, people didn't seem to document it that much, and I'd be curious to know any other kind of theories that you have about why it sort of slipped out of memory, because obviously we were on the cusp of approaching the Industrial Revolution. It could that have played a part of it later on, of just like, you know, Newcastle had its sights on being a powerhouse of industry. The Northeast became known for its industrial legacy, essentially, and mm-hmm. other histories are just sort of maybe not as important.
Yeah, I'd say that plays a role, like maybe a bit later into the 18th and 19th century. And that's where we do start to see discussions of the Newcastle witch trials pop up again in records.
Okay.
So you've got in 1799, Fuller's History of Berwick, he mentions the Newcastle witch trials, and he describes them as humiliating when contrasted with our present enlightened state. And I think he also uses phrases like embarrassing. That's when we get into 19th century stuff for the other theory. Mm-hmm. So, like, we've looked at kind of how the legacy wasn't in its best state to begin with.
Yeah.
Especially in comparison to Pendle with Thomas Potts, A Wonderful Discovery of Witches. We don't really have any equivalent to that. Or in Salem with Cotton Mather's Wonders of the Invisible World. So the 19th century writers didn't really have the same material to touch upon mm-hmm. in the same way. But that doesn't stop them using the witch trials in quite a politicised way at the time. So I mentioned earlier John Fuller and his History of Berwick. John Fuller is what we describe more as an antiquarian rather than what we'd recognise as a historian today. An antiquarian, we'd recognise them more as a kind of collector of old texts that would be assembled together. And when they talk about witchcraft in these antiquarian texts, it's very much to dispel any belief in it anymore and say that this is a product of previous societies, as Fuller describes it, as humiliating to talk about. And to as sort of their justification for addressing this dark part of the past, they'd say that by discussing it, we can put it to bed and it will no longer be part of our society.
This is going to make me sound really stupid. But didn't it come along, like, 1800s? That's when Charles Darwin...
Yeah.
Published, and he sort of like was quoted as like, you know, killing God, because suddenly it became less about the spiritual and dogma, and it became more about like scientific facts and science is the way. So maybe when he says like it was really embarrassing, or we need to like, this is of another time, forget about it, like, could that be in like that kind of thinking at that time, of that we have science now, we don't need these silly superstitions, witches don't exist?
Definitely, but I'd say that like pre-existed.
Okay.
Darwin, a bit like Darwin gets more specific, and it's the whole idea of killing God because of evolution instead. But that's in the same ballpark, yeah. So as well as the early antiquarians talking about it, we do later have folklorists, and to kind of clear up another terminology problem, folklore didn't exist as a coined term for a discipline until 1846, but that hasn't really stopped people confusing antiquarians and folklorists in the timeline. So whereas antiquarians sought to dispel belief in witchcraft and relied more on literary sources like Garner's records, folklorists felt the need to like preserve these records as evidence of a lost England in a way. And a lot of their research was around field work, so they'd actually go out and talk to people, usually poorer people in rural communities, to collect stories of supernatural belief and witchcraft.
Oh wow.
So that's where we see the Newcastle witches and witchcraft in the northeast start to be talked about again. And one of these stories is about a woman called Nanny Scott. And she was known as a local witch, and she read fortunes, made love charms and salves and tinctures for when people were sick. But she was also known to have a black cat and a black dog that were believed to be her familiars. And Brocky describes them as unmitigated savages and thieves. So she was kind of feared and respected in her local community. She was from Sunderland. And it's quite recent to the history that Brocky was talking about. She was reported to have died within 20 years of the text being published, 1886. So you do get a kind of lingering popular belief in witchcraft, just not the drive or the ability to persecute witches on the scale. So you get a sort of similar discussion to Fuller in William Henderson's Notes on the Folklore of Northern Counties of England and the Borders, where he describes witchcraft, he describes witch hunting as the enormous cruelties visited upon their neighbours, talking about local communities driving to hunt witches. So yeah, we see quite a few examples of these brief mentions pop up, but it is just in passing to say our ancestors did this terrible thing. Look how brilliant it makes us look in the enlightened 19th century. And they just move on. In 1881, we do get a bit more of an in-depth discussion. And strangely enough, this comes from just a short story published in the Newcastle Courant. On the 23rd of December. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if this classifies in a way as this qualifies in a way as a Christmas ghost story, I suppose. So the short story also focuses on Margaret Madison, who we mentioned earlier, and it's called The Misery of Margaret Madison, and it's also anonymous in terms of its author. And you can see that whoever wrote this had read Garner's text themselves, sometimes quoting verbatim from it, but there's also comparisons to Matthew Hopkins. And the writer describes the Newcastle Witchfinder as a disciple of Hopkins and says that the panic mania had spread to the north. Rather than kind of looking at an Anglo-Scottish connection, the writer kind of pinpoints Matthew Hopkins and the fear of witches at the start of the 1640s as the cause for the trials in Newcastle.
Is there a reason why they picked Margaret Madison in particular?
It may well have been because of the family name.
So maybe the family would tell a similar story or something about, I don't know, a member of their family. Do you know, I had an auntie who was a witch. Maybe.
People seem quite fascinated with that now.
Yeah.
With finding accused witches in their history. And you've got an association of the descendants of accused witches in Salem,
mm-hmm.
and things like that. So although we don't have a member of the Madison family coming out to say this in print, there is the idea that the author of this short story would have recognised the name too.
And yeah.
Decided that of the list of names, that's who they'd base the story on. But yeah, you can definitely tell that this person has done their research. They include quotes from pamphlets against Matthew Hopkins as well. And you also see the start of the idea of the witch as a herbalist healer in 1881. So this version of Margaret Madison would make up a recipe of a salve to protect and help heal wounds that her mother had kind of handed down into the family. And the story talks about how people in the community appreciated her then, but then when they turned on her for things like her sexual impropriety and things like that, the story becomes twisted. And instead of plants that people would have recognised at the time as helpful, the recipes start to include things like dried bats, a stuffed crocodile, and, to quote, a lot of hairy things that no human Christian could understand.
I don't want to, like, make fun of the situation, but where would they get a crocodile from in North Tyneside? In Newcastle.
In 1650.
In 1650.
As well, yeah.
Did they go to Florida or Africa? Like, where would... What?
I think this is perhaps where how meticulously researched the short story is starts to slip. With the mention of a stuffed crocodile. But it shows the kind of... a kind of Victorian version of these fanciful ideas of the kind of hysterical people of the past.
Yeah, because I can imagine a Victorian society would have seen a stuffed crocodile.
Yeah,
because by then they were travelling, they were bringing things back, they had museums, you know, science was a big thing, but I don't believe that somebody in 1650 would have known what a crocodile was, let alone have access to one.
But I think we can put that down to a bit more of this unnamed writer's historical accuracy slipping a little bit there, rather than... getting too far in. So another thing that will become a trend in historical witch fiction later on is that the story is also a romance.
Of course it is. That makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, you can see these trends that we recognise in much later witch fiction pop up really early in the 19th century. But Margaret has a relationship with a sailor that had gone away, and... because she wasn't married to him, that was partly why people cast aspersions on her. And again, you see a kind of more diffuse understanding of a witch that pops up in the 19th century. So rather than it being like a specific crime of harm by magic, we see the start of it becoming a label for an ungodly woman in any sense. And then at the end of the story, there's the kind of dramatic reveal that the sailor comes back and witnesses Margaret's hanging.
My God, how tragic.
Yeah, so we are, again, starting to see, like, tropes.
Yeah, the whole, like, tragic, unrequited love, all that sort of thing that you see in literature and films and any kind of art about witches anyway today, or any sort of supernatural. There seems to be a lot of that.
Yeah, so this story is a kind of perfect example of how, although it uses local records, we are already starting to see the Newcastle witches become absorbed by wider ideas of historical witchcraft and romance stories and things like that. So I guess this brings us back to another reason why the Newcastle witches have been forgotten to a certain extent, is because the stories have just been absorbed by wider witch kitsch, as I call it, shorthand.
A fascinating discussion, because, like, what are you saying, like, about how witches were beginning to be portrayed? The further away we got from the original trials, you know, the anger, to sort of going into the 1800s and 1900s, it's, you can see parallels to how, you know, when we use witch as a derogatory term nowadays, you know, like a lewd woman, somebody who's, you know, not married, an opinionated woman, an outspoken woman, or, you know, all this stuff. These little things are starting to appear.
Mm-hmm.
And now it very much, you know, is when we talk about, you know, when we hear women being called witches, a lot of the time they have those traits, which is kind of, it's like it's gone full circle from imagination to real reality. Only vaguely upsetting.
Definitely. So, yeah, the short story in 1881 is kind of where things start to go quiet again for discussions of the Newcastle witches. And it's not until 1990 when we see a more detailed or like evidence-based discussion again. And this is just a small mention in the Journal of Northumberland and Durham Family History Society's 1990 issue, with an article called "Was Your Ancestress a Witch?" And then it includes an excerpt from St. Andrew's Burial Register with the names of the victims.
Nowadays you call that clickbait.
I think it would have come from a victimhood perspective. Not trying to say that these women were witches, but it definitely has the kind of "was your ancestress a witch?" It has a very sensational grab of attention. But it just seems quite strange to just briefly put that there and then they move on to discussing coal mine disasters instead right after. So, and around the same time period in 1999, I think Joe might have mentioned the discovery of the witch in St. Mary's.
Yes, because we spoke about it very early on in the podcast.
So that was in 1999, and there was kind of speculation whether she was a witch because she was buried in a what we described as a deviant burial. So she was outside parish boundaries and she wasn't buried in the same direction that other people would have been at the time. And they used, I think it was a clay pipe found in her grave to identify that it was from around 1645 to 1650 or so. So speculation about her specifically is that she might have been a victim of the Civil War, but mm-hmm. the deviant burial might suggest suicide was another, mm-hmm. like victims of suicide would also be buried outside of church boundaries or in a different way to regular deaths. Mm-hmm. She was also buried naked too. That's another detail that people add to speculate that there was something about this woman that deemed her unfit for a Christian burial.
I think it's such a shame that so much of the region's history has been forgotten or even reduced to details and almost like scary stories you tell and on Halloween.
Yeah, and I think just to go back to industrialization again and kind of why this resurgence in interest happened so late in the Newcastle Witches case, when the Northeast did pivot to more of a tourist economy, it focused on working class culture and immediately celebrating, preserving and memorialising its role in the Industrial Revolution, whether that be from the Northumbrian enlightenment of science and engineering or working class culture at places like Beamish. That kind of enveloped the heritage industry and didn't really leave much room for witchcraft. Whereas in Salem, we see a similar sort of thing happen with deindustrialization or losses to local industry happen a few times in Salem's history. And you see Salem witch souvenirs pop up as early as the mid-19th century. So things like hand cream was a popular one of the first ones. It was marketed on the premise that this was like a secret witch's potion and the kind of version of the witch that would use these potions to make herself look young and beautiful forever. So it's not unheard of that deindustrialization would bring about interest in witchcraft heritage and witchcraft history. So that kind of makes it more surprising that it hasn't really happened in Newcastle. Mm-hmm. Based on that, we can compare the Northeast with the Northwest in terms of remembering witchcraft histories, because the Northeast was known as especially patriarchal and masculine in its industries, whereas in Lancashire, obviously famous for the Pendle witches, there was a kind of tipped gender balance and more women went to work in textile industries and things like that. And there was an understanding of the importance of a woman's role in the family to a greater extent than maybe was happening in the Northeast at the time. And coupled with the earlier stuff, with the Lancashire witches being talked about by Thomas Potts and in plays and things like that, I think we can combine that to feed forward into the 19th century and into the 20th century too.
Even books claiming to be, like, you know, definitive histories of the region sort of have a very big hole around that, this point in Newcastle's history, and it was really significant.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I've noticed that most of the historical figures that are memorialised in the Northeast tend to be men.
Definitely, yeah. And even when you do see women talked about, there is a book called Angels of the North or mm-hmm. something that does cover female figures in the region's history. They're all kind of very industrial focused from the 19th century onwards. But I'd say there definitely is a kind of a dominance of male heroes in local history. Yeah.
I think talking to you now, it's made me even happier that we pursued this project, that we made this podcast and told this story and maybe helped to raise some awareness of the Newcastle witches. I had so many preconceptions going into making this podcast. And as I now know, and as anybody who's listened to the podcast knows, these witch trials didn't exist in a vacuum. They were part of a wider problem in society and things that were happening at the time in the city. And that has been sort of very fascinating to unpick, but also I think really important to remember. So thank you again, Katie, for appearing on another episode of this podcast and for once again bringing us such fascinating insight into this story.
Yeah, it's great to get opportunities like this, because there are definite influences of other understandings of the witch and in media, especially the midwife myth, the belief that all witches were kind of misunderstood healers or secretly actually practicing witchcraft and stuff. It gets a bit wild, and I'm a little bit precious of the Newcastle witches to protect them from those influences.
I feel that. I'm feeling like I'm protective of them too now.
When you get close to the story, I think it's natural, especially I guess because it is such a kind of new development that people are starting to talk about them again, that they're almost more vulnerable than more well-established mm-hmm. or famous cases. The popularity of the more fantasy witch is at least partly responsible in like renewing interest in the Newcastle witches. But I guess I'm still a little bit protective of getting them memorialised first, and then we can discuss them as kind of part of the wider witchy media nebula, I suppose.
You've been listening to the Newcastle Witches podcast. Thank you for joining us. We will be back soon with our final episode. In the meantime, you can find us on social media under the Newcastle Witches podcast.